Denise, Gordy, and Roy with you at the breakfast table, as always. And our guest, Rob Lohman, interventionist and recovery coach. Rob, welcome back to the table. You've been here before. Good to see you again.
Nice to see you, Rob.
Thank you very much. It's great to see all of you, too.
Well, I noticed when I went on, actually an article, I think it was Psychology Today interviewed you, and I saw an article that talked about your specialties, and I thought, wow, we got problems out there in the world. You deal with addiction, spirituality, life transition issues, alcohol abuse, career counseling, coping skills, drug abuse, gambling, and on and on and on. We've got problems, don't we?
We do, yeah. A lot of people trying to fill their voids with things that are not tangible. So
yeah, and I know you've gone through some things in your life as well. You're well-educated at University of Texas at Dallas, MBA, as well as addictions training, and you are ready to delve into this with people who are willing. I guess they have to be willing, don't they?
Yeah, it's willing, and then the family wants their loved one to be willing, and that's the trick, is working with the family and the individuals to get them on the right path.
And you personally have gone through things. You don't have to enumerate if you don't care to, but I know you've struggled with some things which really makes it real for you. You not only have information, you have experience as well.
Yeah, unfortunately too much experience. I mean, I grew up as a Christian kiddo and was just kind of wired differently than a lot of kids, so alcohol really became a big part of my life at age 14, really to all the way to 29, and it was just anything you can imagine in between there, I probably did it, and was not proud of a lot of it, but it was the journey that I went on, and God kept me alive for a greater purpose, which I'm fulfilling now, I believe. And for me, it was attempted suicide the night before I got clean and sober.
Mm.
And from a guy that could drink up to 2 bottles of scotch in a day.
Wow.
And yeah, I was in sales and marketing, so I was like, that was my excuse.
Yeah,
you know, taking clients out, doing whatever we did. But, you know, God really got my attention that night and the next day. And, you know, I went one of those cases where I didn't go through detox or withdrawal or anything. I literally, you know, tried to kill myself the night before, woke up the next day, and my aunt ended up taking me to an AA meeting. And I found people that were jovial and they loved their life sober. And I'm like, I'm in. And but the fact I didn't go through detox or withdrawal, and I honestly have not had a craving in 17 years, despite all the stuff I've been through in recovery. And I can only
that is absolutely amazing because there have been people who have almost died from just going cold turkey, just off alcohol, not to speak of anything else. And so just to have that taken away is an absolute miracle.
Yeah, it still blows me away today because now that I'm in the field
Wonderful.
And work with a lot of people, you know, alcohol and opioids are two things people can die from if they try to just go cold turkey.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I know plenty of people have tried it and it's been miserable and they have almost died, loved ones that I know, and but it's not something to mess around with and try to do on your own and get professional help.
Which of these areas that you deal with is most prevalent and or which has the most success in dealing with?
Wow, that's a great question. I mean, they're such different, unique animals. I mean, between, you know, alcoholism and or opioid addictions or gambling or sex addictions, they all have so many different nuances to them. Unfortunately, there's not a whole lot of programs out there for people that deal with gambling and sex addictions from, like, a treatment perspective, like a residential treatment-type facility. But, you know, there's so much mental health issues going on in our country right now that that's something that's not really talked about. And people hide behind the stigma a lot, too. It's, well, if I come tell you, Roy, that I have a problem at work, I might lose my job.
Sure, yeah.
Well, there's a lot of protection out there that people don't know, too, that I help them with, and as far as keeping their jobs and, you know, protection of American Disabilities Acts and, you know, FMLA and all those that can help, you know, keep the container safe where they can go to their employers and ask for help, like their EAP programs. So things to check into.
I'm sorry, can I ask you, is an addiction as simple as tracking it back to, say, a quote-unquote pleasure center in the brain that people are looking for?
Yeah,
it has
a lot to do with dopamine in your brain chemicals, because when I started using it at 14, you know, my brain doesn't stop developing until I'm 26. So those 12 years of not working on great cognitive function and reasoning and conflict resolution and those completely affects the brain in a huge way, to where a lot of times you don't really know the false from reality and you're so disconnected from what's going on in front of you that people are sick. And it is an illness. People look at it like a moral dilemma, right? You probably heard that before, of, well,
sure,
just quit drinking.
Yeah.
Just stop. It's like, okay, well, you stopped eating chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
You love it. Try stop eating chocolate or
stop buying clothes.
Yeah.
Or something.
Stop doing something that brings you pleasure, just like that.
Yeah. It's prevalent in the church. We know how prevalent.
Oh wow, extremely prevalent. It's. And unfortunately, people in the church don't feel comfortable coming forward either because then...
Probably more so.
Yeah, depending on
I think more so.
Yeah, because you'll be looked down upon or the congregation, that kind of condemnation thing, which stinks in the church because it's supposed to be the safe place for people that are sick and struggling.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's, I mean, all over the church. I mean, even in leadership, and we see it a lot on, you know, news reports and stuff of pastors that had fallen because they're so spent and so overworked and so underappreciated a lot of times. I think in their own isolation of their profession.
Mm-hmm. It has to really be hard because we've heard people have to want to quit. People have to want to change. And yet what they're doing is so comfortable. It's where they live. It's their comfort zone. That's got to be tough.
Definitely tough. And one of the things I always say is that as addicts, people struggling with addiction, I know some people get caught up in the terminologies, but someone has a substance abuse problem. Picture it like being on the elevator and you're going down, and you want to get off the elevator, but you don't know how to push the button, and you just keep going and going, and then you hit ground floor, and most elevators stop. But as addicts and people suffering from substance abuse, we have the ability to go way below ground and keep going and going and going and causing more trouble in our life. But I think deep down, people want to quit. They just don't know how to quit.
Right. Yeah. I would agree with that.
Well, I would think there's a whole bunch of people right now listening that are either there or they have a relative that's there or they know someone that is there.
Rob Lohman with us at the Breakfast Table, interventionist, recovery coach, and we're talking about addictions. Addictions are addictions. It's when you just can't let go of something. But there is a big question around people who are dealing with chronic pain constantly, and they have to live. They have to work, or they have to. They have things they have to do, but they cannot do them because of the pain they suffer. And so, how do you approach a person like that? How does that person deal with the pain, but yet not be on something to help them with the pain? It doesn't work for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, I think, the conundrum of people having those struggles and what do they do. And one in our society. One of the big reasons I think we have a lot of people have a heroin epidemic is because people start out on legitimate pain pills, right? And they have a legitimate surgery that just is unbearable pain.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have to figure out how do you transition from that when your prescription runs out or you can't afford the medication or anything anymore. And a lot of people start buying stuff on the streets or doing things they shouldn't be doing, which is highly illegal to be buying pills from someone else that aren't prescribed to you. And then they become addicted to heroin, and then we have this issue now that there's a lot of places out there that can help with that. But it is a hard situation, especially, I think, from a Christian perspective, too.
Mm-hmm, absolutely,
you know, when you look at that a little bit differently, that you know some people don't want to be medicated, but there's legitimate pain on how do you deal with that. And there are you know places out there, you know, clinics out there, things that can help people try to manage that pain, but it just has to get to, for some people, what's their pain tolerance.
And could we clarify, is there a difference in being able to manage pain? Some people say I can handle pain well, others can't at all.
They have a
is
low threshold or a high threshold for tolerance.
Is that legitimate?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, okay. I think there's, but after you take pills for so long, the mindset is like, I have to have that to manage the pain. So sometimes there's a mental block for some people.
Plus your brain changes, from what I understand.
Yeah.
You're actually physically changes.
Yeah, it does. And because the pain blocks the pain receptor, the medication blocks the pain receptors in your body.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're used to taking 4 pills a day and you go down to 3 pills a day, you know, it could be like, okay, that's a little more manageable because I don't want to be on medication for the rest of my life. And some people just have to be. And I'm not a doctor or a therapist, I mean, anything like that to, you know, go deep into the medical realm of that. So I always just say if people are struggling and trying to figure out how to get off of something, but if you have like legitimate pain, like 5 compressed discs and you move one way and it is just killing you.
Sure.
You know, then it's something that's needed to keep them along the way. But there are groups out there and places that can help on a more detailed basis than I can. But so I do a lot of work in the addiction field and the addiction world of doing interventions and doing coaching. And I work with a treatment center out of Texas and Florida and Virginia called Recovery Unplugged, where we do music-based therapy, and we help people get off of drugs.
Interesting.
It's a really cool, unique program of how music, and like what you all do, I mean, you play so much music, great music on your station, and people are listening to it, and just some of those dormant emotions get get kind of unlocked and open. And if you don't know what to do with those emotions when they happen, and say you're in substance abuse, you drown them. Right, you drown them in the alcohol because you're remembering something that happened when you were a kid or a divorce or something like that. And so what we do is use music as a pathway for healing and a catalyst to unlock those emotions and then help people figure out what I like to call like recovery triggers of just like how do you trigger your recovery in a healthy way to move you forward from those things that used to cause you to drink and use.
Yeah. Well, let's come back and talk about some of these other areas. Certainly, we hit on a huge one with what we just talked about, the opioid problem. What about gambling, self-esteem, stress, suicidal ideation, and so forth? Maybe we can hit on some of those, which certainly are as critical, but not maybe in the big picture these days, you know, on the front page
of the
news.
Yeah, I guess I'm wondering, is an addiction, addiction, an addiction? Or do we separate them out?
Yeah, I think, well, one of the things I love, my wife always has said this from one of her therapists from years ago, and I love the way it wraps around, is addiction is the inability to deal with emotional pain.
Mm-hmm.
So if we have started to gamble to cover up pain of something, then as we gamble a little bit, then our brain changes, right? The dopamine levels in our brain change, so that, that little boring nickel, excuse me, or penny slot is now no longer fun. So I'm going to go to the craps table, or I'm going to go start another business that's a big gamble, right? Or I'm going to sneak around with a mistress in my life, and there's another gamble. So gambling has so many different facets to it that it's that risk-taking adrenaline rush. But as the more we do it, our dopamine levels change and are depleted, so we got to have more to keep going, and then we're in this thing of, like, I just can't get more.
7:32, we're with Rob Lohman, interventionist and recovery coach. We've been talking about a lot of issues that are in people's lives and how to deal with those. You deal with them on a regular basis, Rob, and I think you're going to share a little more of your story as well. But once again, the phone number, if somebody missed it, to how to get in touch with you.
970-331-4469.
All right. You want to jump in with more of your story to begin with?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting about recovery is that you get sober in this kind of this pink cloud journey, right? And you're so excited to not be, you know, for anyone's story is like, you know, they're shooting a needle in their arm or drinking a bottle of scotch in a day or whatever it is. I was not a needle user, but I enjoyed psychedelic drugs when I used to like to drink quite a bit. And along that journey, you kind of get lost in your drinking and drug world. You know, I kind of became this chameleon, right? To be your friend, I would act the way you, like the Discover commercials now, right? Like I'll act the way you act so you will like me. And then, and I just got lost in that whole journey and process through college and just kind of a meandering soul, if you will. And just not having a whole lot of attachment to stuff because it was just kind of life just happening. And, you know, in transitions, it'd be like, well, I have couches. Okay, I'll give them away. I'll find couches wherever I move next. And it was just a simple transition. But as I started getting real desperate towards the end, and growing up as a believer, not dying in situations I should have died in, I just always believed in the back of my head that God was keeping me alive for something bigger and better. Mm. And so, therefore, I felt indestructible because I felt like he had my back. And so it's kind of like using grace as an excuse to sin, right? God will just cover that. And, but it was kind of towards the end of my drinking where I just had this desperation growing inside of me. And I'm sure a lot of people listening have this too, where you just start wanting things to be different. And like in the Bible, it talks about why do I do the things I don't want to do? And why do I don't do the things I wish I was doing? And this challenge of I want to be better, but I keep messing up. And so shame and guilt and self-hatred and self-sabotage and self-loathing was like kind of the mantra in my head a lot
of those are spiritual attacks too that take advantage of what a person, especially a believer, is going through.
Yeah, 100% believe that too, because you know, we're not battling against each other, we're battling against the forces and spirit and principalities.
Absolutely.
Right? And so in the journey, it was a few months before I wanted to get clean. I would, you know, be dry. I was living in Fort Wayne, Indiana. That's where I was born. Grew up in Texas, went back to Indiana for various reasons. And I would be driving down the highway, you know, sober-ish, you know, hungover from last night, thinking about the drinks for lunch or the evening. But I would literally, like, see my car kind of veer off and hit a median and just explode. And I'd be there, sitting there dead. But I would see this happening. It didn't happen, but I would see it happening. So somewhere in my subconscious and things were building to just be like, you really are a piece of junk. Believe in the lies of our enemy, right?
Sure.
And just believe in those desperate moments. And so I remember I went I'll just skip that part of the story because it's kind of irrelevant. But leading up to this, I was hanging out in a bar in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and all of a sudden the bar got completely dead silent. And then I audibly heard, "You're done." And then it got really loud again.
Wow.
Oh, it was crazy. And I remember looking at my buddy Sean O'Brien. I looked at him, and I was drinking one of those big Foster oil can beers. And I remember putting it down. I was like, "Dude, I got to go home. I have no clue what just happened." And he looks at me. He's like, "All right, whatever." Went on about his business. And I get in my car, and I was pretty inebriated, but I was just like bawling and all this emotional confusion. Like, am I done drinking? What did that mean? And I walk home to my, you know, one bedroom apartment in Fort Wayne, Indiana. It was about 15 stairs up from the front door and just this open loft. And like every good bachelor, you have a workout gym in the middle of your living room. Because I was fit and I had a good job. So I looked good. I had a good job. And everything on the outside was like
healthy,
you know, and just a little apartment while I'm, you know, figuring out what to do. But I walked right past my dog, Jake, and ended up putting 300 and something pounds on my barbell. And laid down on my workout bench. And this is all just kind of happening. So as I tell you the story, I'm like, it's happening. I can see hear every plate just kind of hitting each other. I put all the plates on and laid it on my workout bench and put my hands on the barbell and just pick it up and then just unlock my elbows and just ready to take myself out of the game.
Wow.
But I didn't have that written in the script anywhere. It was just something that was just happening. And as I unlock my elbows, like, all this happens in, like, split seconds, right? I look down, and my dog is nudging my leg, just kind of looking at me with those puppy eyes, dog eyes of, like, you know, "Dad, what are you doing right now?" And my first thought was, oh, my gosh, who's going to feed Jake tomorrow morning? You know, who's going to feed my dog? And I started thinking about my parents and my brother, and, like, good stuff. And meanwhile, my elbows are unlocked with weight that I literally cannot hold.
Oh, my word.
I couldn't bench over 300. But I had that just suspending here. And then all of a sudden it was like, God just, he was holding the bar, right? Just like, okay, let's get through this thought process real quick. Come on, hurry up. But he grabbed that bar and just put it right back on the rack. Mm. And I knew at that point that, I mean, obviously he had me, but I knew that life was going to be different. And I slept that night for the first time in I don't know how long.
Wow.
Just in peace. You know, I mean, I poured out all my scotch. God gave me the strength to pour out all my booze. And I can see all the droplets, like, bouncing out of the sink right now, just pouring that out. And it was, you know, $60 bottles of scotch because I was cool and I was, you know, I had arrived.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was that moment of clarity where I just reached, I picked the phone up, and I meant to call my aunt, who'd been sober 20-plus years, but I accidentally called my parents, you know, and it was that answered prayer. So moms out there, dads, if you're praying for your kids, just
keep praying.
Just don't stop, yeah. You know, because he's listening. And I just remember I told my mom, I was like, "Mom, I can't quit drinking and gambling. I need help." And she said, we just cried as a family for like an hour. To me, it felt like a minute. But she said, we were on the phone and we just cried and wept and she prayed. And, you know, my aunt took me to a meeting and I found people that wanted a healthier life like I did. You know, I got sober in the rooms of AA and 12 steps. That's not the one way to do it. You know, there's multiple ways that people can find recovery, like celebrate recovery and go into treatment and outpatient, like all these avenues out there that I help people with now. But it took me getting to that desperate moment to just want to kill myself to, you know, and I'm not gonna lie, like in sobriety in 17 years, I haven't had those thoughts trickle in and out just based on me not doing working a good program and staying close to people. And
it is, that's such a miracle.
And as an organization, there's a reason Alcoholics Anonymous has been around as long as it has.
It definitely has. Yeah, I mean, it has. I mean, it's a free, self-supporting group. And some people knock it and say it doesn't work. And even Christians will be like, well, they talk about a God of their higher power, a God of their understanding. And I get that. As a believer, I get that, you know, but people just trying to find community in a way to not be drunk and steal and mess their life up. They're trying to find something.
Yeah. And I don't know much about it, but there is a certain Christian protocol that runs through Alcoholics Anonymous, is there not?
Yeah, not necessarily. I mean, it talks about
God-centered.
God-centered.
Yeah.
It doesn't talk about Jesus Christ.
Okay.
But it started from, I mean, the 12 steps started by Bill Wilson and out of the Bible. But to make it more acceptable to everyone else, it was just kind of finding a higher power of your understanding.
Yeah.
You know, and so I just want to encourage believers that are listening, like, don't knock people that are in AA because it works. It works. But now we have Celebrate Recovery, which is like AA through the Bible, through churches and places that do that now. And it's go to Celebrate Recovery and look them up in your local communities and dive into that avenue of it. But it's, I think the whole thing we drink and use, or the way I drink and use, I won't speak for anyone else or you are listening out there, is that because I was missing something and I wanted community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I carry all sorts of things around my pocket. This is like, if you ever heard of Neil Anderson's work, Victory Over the Darkness, killer book, killer program he has. But, you know, this is the I am statements.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I am, like, so when I forget who I am, it's like, you know, I am righteous and holy. I am a citizen of heaven. You know, I am hidden with Christ and God, and just all these sayings with scriptures that remind me who I am.
Because
I'm not an interventionist. I'm not a recovery coach. You know, I'm not an outreach manager for a treatment center. I'm a child of God who does interventions, who does recovery coaching, who is blessed to work with a great treatment center, Recovery Unplugged. You know, so
good
I
perspective.
Yeah, so it's. Yeah. Who am I? I'm a child of God, and I get to do all this other stuff because of that.
For that believer who is listening right now, get them over that first step of being absolutely panicked at the thought of sharing what their addiction is, or that they have an addiction with their, I don't know, with their significant other, their husband, their wife, their boss, their friend, I don't know. That there's a panic that happens, especially with a believer.
Oh, yeah. To be exposed?
To be exposed.
And for you to actually know what I do behind closed doors?
Yeah.
I'm not going to tell anybody that. And that was a huge part, which we can get into, like, maybe in the next break, is just when my mental breakdown involved. But there's a lot of shame, because a lot of people are addicted or are cross-addicted. You know, it's easy to see the alcohol. It's hard to see the pornography. It's easy to see the pills. It's hard to see the gambling. You know, so it's a lot of the secrets are the things that are killing people.
We're talking to our guest, Rob Lohman, interventionist and recovery coach, a brother in Christ. He approaches this all from that standpoint. And that song, you know, Something Beautiful Over My Life, a lot of people say, yeah, I want that. But they really have to want it, don't they? They have to be willing to make some changes. And, Rob, you were telling us your story earlier. If you missed it, it's going to be on As Heard a little bit later. We'll have that up on our website on the As Heard button. But there's another part to your story that you wanted to share.
You know, that song you just played is so incredible because I didn't think I was that beautiful or that great of a guy towards the end of my addiction, right? And then there comes the night of suicide, finding people in recovery, and just doing this recovery journey. But the interesting thing is when I got sober, I wasn't married and I didn't have children, you know? And so life was simpler and different, right? And then God took me through a couple really cool journeys up to the point of 2006 where I had this big vision on my heart. I mean, if you remember, I did the God Rally Project, this big free 3-day Christian music festival. And in the process, I meet my wife, who works with K-Love Radio, and just, you know, she was a promotions manager for them. And all these wheels started turning. But in the way, like, as has been said before, like, my house wasn't in order, you know, getting married and all those things, too, just some things that probably needed to be taken care of before then. But you get married, and we got pregnant right away, had a miscarriage, you know, got pregnant right away after that. And so God was saying, like, you're supposed to have children. And I loved it because I was really excited to be a dad. But there was a lot of insecurities I had had about being a husband and a dad that I didn't know about until I was a husband and a dad. And just kind of the quick journey is just kind of through that, you know, trying to figure out how to support my family and do it well. And so I ended up getting a really good job, which they closed that division and then started my own business as an insurance guy. And that was the hardest thing I'd ever done. And so, you know, if you're out there and you're have young kids and your wife works nights and weekends and you're, I mean, it wasn't a great combination for us. And just over time with sleep deprivation and not doing my recovery well, not going to a lot of meetings, not plugging into Bible studies and men's groups. And I had this whole plethora of friends and acquaintances, but I slowly kind of started like isolating myself. And it was starting to get to be a little lonely journey. And as things were kind of unraveling with getting ready to lose my agency because of sales and production numbers, I started feeling like I was pretty worthless. You know, and I know a lot of people listening have been through those journeys too, of just like, I'm not good enough. I can't measure up. And so all this self-loathing was happening. And I'm a Christian, right? Like, whoa, like, I'm not supposed to believe this junk. I'm supposed to believe this page I have here in my hand that says, I am, you know, I am the light of the world. I am all these things. But I wasn't believing any of that. So Satan, our enemy, really started kind of taking over my beliefs in myself. So fear kind of overtook my faith. You know, isolation, you know, became my thing instead of being in community. And, you know, long story short, I lost my agency in November 2011. My wife quit her job December 2011 because our adrenals were just shot. Wasn't healthy living and just too busy, right? And then February 2012 comes along, and I just had a major nervous breakdown one night. And I won't get into all the stories of that, too, because it's on my podcast and things people can listen to. But basically, I just had a humongous breakdown and just lost it one night. And that led me to eventually confess to what I had done, trusting God with the whole process. And he did a lot of amazing miracles in the journey. But I ended up going to prison for what was supposed to be 13 years. God had a different plan, thank goodness, and I was out in 10 and a half months. And in this process, my wife had to figure out who's the Yahoo that I married. And just knowing that was the guy that wasn't the guy she married, that was the guy that snapped under life pressure. And so I'm grateful that she stayed with me and we continue to work through that, through those pains, because there's a lot of collateral damage. But I mean, essentially my life was, I lost my agency in 2011. I snapped in 2012. I went to prison in 2013. I lived in a halfway house in 2014 and finally moved back home in 2015. And so trying to rebuild our marriage and everything from there. And my kids just know that Daddy messed up. Mm-hmm. He went to camp to get closer to God. And he came home. And while I was incarcerated, I became a reader and figured out why I believe what I believe. I actually read the Bible from front to back. Amazing. What an idea to do as a believer. And I just really re-secured my faith in who I am. And now I can stand on who I am and whose I am and not what everybody wants me to be or how they see me.
Yeah. 8:15 is our time. You're with Denise, Gordy, and Roy at the breakfast table, and our guest, Rob Lohman, interventionist and recovery coach, a brother in Christ who has gone through it. He knows some experience, but he's well educated and trained in this area, and now working in it as a Christian who happens to do these kinds of things. Talk a little bit, and then we'll just kind of open up the table to any questions of each of us. But talk about the systemic aspect of it. It's not one person's problem. It's many persons' problem, the loved ones as well. What should they do? What should they not do?
Most definitely, yeah. And I think that can be some of the hardest piece to this puzzle, because the normal is to revolve our lives around the addict, right, and the substance abuser. So that's our normal. So when that person potentially gets healthy, usually the family's kind of left in the dust. So what do we do? Like, Billy went to treatment, or Billy's going to recovery, or Sarah's over here. So what do we do? And that's one of the things I think is really key, because it is a systemic problem. You know, have spouses call and want their husband to get help, and I can't believe he's doing this to me. And I say, well, how long have you been married? Say 20 years. I'm saying, so you've been there the whole 20 years, right? Yes. And people don't like to hear this, but it's kind of like you're part of the problem, but also part of the solution. Mm-hmm. And so what tools do we give you to be a part of the solution? And there's a lot of amazing programs out there too that can help people. So when I'm coaching families and things, I'm, you know, a lot of programs have really good family programs. Like Recovery Unplugged has a great family program for our clients that go through the music-based treatment center we were talking about earlier. And it's giving them the education of how does addiction work in the brain? How did the addict get there? How did you help them get there? And what do we do to undo this codependent nature of dependency of the trauma and the drama to keep things going? Because it's really hard when someone goes to get clean and has a spiritual awakening or a cleansing, whatever people want to call it, and they get sober and get on a different path. You know, and some people, like, they just love Jesus and they love God and they're like, woohoo! And then the family's over here like, you jerk. Like, look what you caused in my life. What about me?
Well, how do I deal with
How do I deal with this? Like, I'm glad you're healthy, but so when people go to get help and things, I say, you know, tap into things like Al-Anon, which is an amazing program that helps people locally. Adult children of alcoholics. If your parents were alcoholics, that affected you a ton, even though you might have been a little kid. But that really helped shape a lot of people. Or Celebrate Recovery for life issues of like spouses that are dealing with recovery. If you want to do a church-based program, there's so many avenues out there that, and that's what I guide people towards. And so like when people call me or go to my website, you know, they can find me to connect with them. Two are the right resources to get them help. And, I mean, again, my mom was praying for years, right? I caused her a lot of mental torment. They were just glad to see me sober.
Yeah.
There's a lot of collateral damage in this, isn't there?
Yeah, and you don't even know the extent of it. I mean, I remember when I got sober and I'd have these blackout drunks, and I'd drive from Fort Wayne, Indiana to Gary, Indiana, about 2 hours away, in a complete blackout, going to the casinos, coming back, and I would have no clue I even went. I just had poker chips in my pocket, knowing that I had evidence that I had gone. And the problem with poker chips in your pocket 2 hours away is you have to go back to cash them in. You know what I mean? It was just this crazy cycle, and I'm out of that cycle, thank goodness. And the reason I got into this is because having felonies on my record, it was really hard to find a good sales job after I got out of prison.
Mm-hmm.
And so employers give people a chance, you know, and give people a break. But that's why I got in this field, because no one can tell you you cannot start your own business.
Right.
You know,
right.
And so now I get to do the work I do and help families along the way and get them the right resources. And one other cool thing I want to bring up is the power of music, right? So whenever I go to a church service and there's a couple songs that play, Oceans and Holy Spirit, I remember like when I was incarcerated, we had a chapel on site out in Delta. And I remember that just the Ocean song because my friend Jeremy, who was in there, and I got to know him when I was in there, worked really hard to get the praise team to play the song, get the lyrics sent in. But we would always hold our Bibles up. And that was our time of worship, to say, this is the Word of God. And we would just hold our Bibles up during that song. And so even today when I go to Red Rocks Church, when I go to church, I'm constantly holding my Bible up in praise. And it feels weird because no one else is doing it, but that's my remembrance of the pain I had when I was there, but also where I kind of resealed my faith. And so when we do this therapy in these treatment centers at our Recovery Unplugged, and I talk to people about the power of music, like that song is a positive trigger, even though I was in a bad place, but it was a positive trigger of recovery for me to remember the pain I went through to get where I am today. It's just so cool to help people, and it's so sad when people want to help and then they get scared because change is coming.
It's a tough road to recovery, but it starts with what?
It starts with just accepting the fact there's an issue for a lot of people, but also the family, the systemic part, it starts with them to say, hey, it's time to buck up and just get together. And even though doing interventions like I do isn't like my most favorite thing, because you're kind of surrounding the individual to say, hey, there's a problem, but there's a bunch of different ways to do interventions. But the family has to get to a point where they're ready to say, enough is enough, and I'm willing to make the change too, and not just expecting him or her to do all the work. Because everybody got there together.
Do you find that in most cases, when it gets to a certain point and families are willing to accept the responsibility of being enablers?
It's beautiful when that happens. Because even if the addict's not ready, they're ready. And because they're learning how to put a healthy boundaries up and help create change, eventually the substance abuser, I just keep changing the terms because the addict is realizing that, wow, Like, Dad didn't just give me $20 for pot. Mm-hmm. Like, he's might be serious. He'll give in next week. Next week comes, and I just tell the family, you have to be consistent. And this might be 6 months of you holding your boundaries until that person actually realizes, okay, I'm ready.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because if they're just not ready, like,
there's nothing.
You hope something switches when they go somewhere to get help.
Yeah.
But if they're just 100% like resistant, not ready and stuff, it's, you know, the chances of effectiveness go down, but you just hope something will switch.
Rob, thanks so much for being here this morning. Great morning. Wow. Great stuff.
Wonderful information.
All right, we need to connect people with you. That could be a start. You might send them somewhere else, but at least they can talk with you to get the start. And phone number and website, give it out now if you would, please.
Yeah, phone number, you can text me, email me, whatever, text me or call me, 970-331-4469. And if you want to tap into all the different things I do with my podcast and Recovery Unplugged and everything else, go to theaddictionrecoveryhub.com. And that's theaddictionrecoveryhub.com.
Thanks so much.
Very much, Rob. Thank you so much. Lord be with you.
Yeah, amen. Thank you.